This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A lot has changed in Charlotte since 1968. That was 45 years ago. Now imagine how much it will change in the next 45 years. What will this town be like in 2058? Charlotte Magazine has used up a lot of ink looking back 45 years and ahead by the same amount of time as a way of observing their 45th anniversary. They were curious about what Charlotte was like when it was a small city and what it might be like when we turn into a really large city. Their reports illustrate just how Charlotte's past may affect its future. We travel along that 90-year timeline this hour with Michael Graff. He's the executive editor of Charlotte Magazine and the writer behind the article, The Future 2058, which appears in the September issue. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
That article also appears with the past article, 1968, written by Chuck McShane, who is a freelance writer who contributes to the magazine quite frequently. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And David Walters, architect, town planner, professor, and coordinator of the Master of Urban Design program at UNC Charlotte, is also with us to help us get our bearings about where we are and where we may be going in the future. Welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
And we're calling on the expertise of Tom Hanchett in this first segment of the history of Charlotte. Tom is the staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just saw you yesterday, didn't I?
Yeah.
Charlotte was a small town in 1968 when your magazine started publishing. Was there really enough to write about back then? I really thought about this yesterday. I thought, really? There was a Charlotte magazine in 1968? What did you write about? You weren't here. You weren't even born.
Well, no, I certainly wasn't at the magazine at the time, but... No, this whole issue started when we were planning our 45th anniversary issue, and we needed to come up with an idea that wasn't to talk about our magazine. When we produced this issue, we didn't want to have an issue where we just put a bunch of old Charlotte magazine covers and old Charlotte magazine stories on there. We really wanted to celebrate Charlotte and look at the town of Charlotte and see what had happened since 68 and see where it was going to 58, and it actually started with an editorial or an op-ed piece that Tom wrote in the Observer, and I read it and realized that Charlotte was a smaller town than Birmingham in 68, and it had grown significantly in 45 years, and it surpassed Birmingham, and I thought, it's really amazing to think what can happen in 45 years, and then you start thinking about what can happen 45 years from now, and it's just remarkable.
So Tom and Chuck, since Chuck, you wrote the article about the past, what was Charlotte like in 1968? How big was it, Tom?
I knew you were going to ask that, but I only knew it after I sat down here. Do you know the
Chuck?
Exact population?
It was about 250,000 people.
Wow.
And
Mecklenburg County is going to hit a million sometime this week. So,
and geographically speaking, when you said the city of Charlotte, what was the city?
Didn't go much further out on the east side than Eastway. I think that's the city boundary was around there at that point.
Sounds about right.
51 was a country road down in the south. There were no big shopping centers. South Park and Eastland had been considered, but they didn't exist yet. People shop downtown, except for the few folks in South Charlotte that went to Park Road Shopping.
So when you say 250,000 people lived in Charlotte, that was the city's population. When you included Mecklenburg County and the surrounding areas, were we pretty much an island of a quarter of a million people in the midst of farmland?
Indeed.
Farmland and small towns.
Wow. Well, we talk a lot about the demise of the down or the uptown area in the 80s and 90s before its current revival. In 1968, what was downtown like?
It was hopping because there was no real alternative in terms of shopping except for Park Road Shopping Center and some small neighborhood stores like around where the Visualite is in Elizabeth or where the Manor Theater is in Myers Park. So folks still very much focused on the center city, mm-hmm. and I think if those people came back today, they would enjoy what they find downtown, except downtown has very little retail now,
right?
Though it's a bustling place, which it was not when I came to Charlotte in 1981.
And Chuck, you point out that after dark, people fled downtown. They were not here.
Correct, yes. It was once the retail stores closed, there wasn't much else down here for people.
So where did they go?
They tended to stay at home or something at the Coliseum.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot to do, was there? By today's standards, in 1968, there wasn't a lot to do, which brings me back to my original question. What the heck did you write about in Charlotte Magazine? Did we have skyscrapers? We didn't have malls. We've already established that. Did we have interstates?
We had 85 had been built, and there were plans for 77 at the time, but it had not been built yet.
So what was where 77 is? Just it was neighborhoods, farmland?
In the center city? Yeah. 277 in the center city was mostly African-American neighborhoods, which were being demolished in 1968.
This is Brooklyn.
That was the high point of what was called urban renewal, and the Brooklyn neighborhood gave way to the government center, but also smaller neighborhoods around the edge of the city, Greenville, for instance, mm-hmm. Where the 77-277 junction is now. That was getting ready to be condemned.
Mm. You have a map that accompanies both of these articles, a future map and a past map, and it's particularly effective in the online edition because you can hover over it with your mouse and things appear and disappear at will to show what is going to happen and what it looks like, what it looked like in 1968. If you hover over that 68 aerial map, it looks like you're looking from South End toward uptown. And there are no buildings. So I think the tallest building I see downtown is like a 10-story building. I don't know what building that was. Do you?
Probably would have been the Johnston Building, which is still there. There was the Independence Building at the Square, which has come down. There were a number of, maybe a handful of 1920 skyscrapers, and that was all that was here until pretty much the time that David Walters and I moved to town.
And the 1920 skyscraper would have been what? 10 stories, 11 stories?
10, 15 stories.
And that one of those buildings would have been, what, the Latta Building, perhaps?
The Johnston Building is still there, and also what's now the SunTrust Bank, which was, when it was built in the 20s, was the tallest building in North Carolina.
When did the modern look of Charlotte begin to be constructed then?
Late 60s, there are a few skyscrapers that go up. We have at Levine Museum of the New South, we have a big mural photo from 1976 that shows like four tall buildings. And one is the NCNB building and one is the Union National Bank building. And there's not much else.
Well, those tall buildings replaced something. So when we started putting up those tall buildings, and I know your article doesn't go into this, so I'm not going to point this question to you, Chuck. Were we tearing things down? Were we tearing Charlotte history down? Were we tearing significant pieces of history down, or were we just tearing down things that needed to go anyway? They had their life cycle, and it's time to move on.
That's a loaded question. It depends on where you stood at that time. Today, we would look back at the buildings that were torn down, such as the Independence Building, which went down in the 1980s, and mourn for them. At that point, those buildings were not that old, and that was a period when America did not think much of its history. History sort of stopped at Colonial Williamsburg, and the notion that there might be history in the 20th century was pretty radical. And so anything that dated from the late 19th, early 20th century, let's get rid of it. It's just old. It's not historic.
So with 250,000 people, what was rush hour like? Was there one? Was it long? Was it short?
Not as rough.
Was Trade Street closed as it is today?
There was a lot of construction downtown. This is the time you started seeing the new patterns of the one-way streets happen here. There were a lot more narrow streets, and so there was a lot of traffic. People complained about traffic a lot.
Really?
Yes.
Was it justifiable from our point of view, do you think?
I have no real way of knowing, but I doubt it.
None of you were born then, were you? Your job was to look back to 1968 through the eyes of an average Charlottean. So how did you do that? And what kinds of things did you see through that person's eyes?
Well, writing in the second person was one thing that I wanted to do. Sort of by looking through someone's eyes who was living there, we were able to sort of get some of the uncertainty that was going on during that time, that someone who was living during that time would have felt. Mm-hmm. I think by looking back now, we all know what happened. You know, history is kind of a highlight reel. But by going back and uncovering some of the smaller stories, we are unable to unearth a little bit more of the uncertainty that people felt.
What were they uncertain about?
The future. The crime was on the rise. There was a lot of fear of cities.
Yeah, this is amazing. I knew this, but I'd never seen it in print before, and I'm trying to find it in my notes. But in that year, in 1968, we had the second highest murder rate in the country.
Yes. There were 46 murders, and there were 52 murders last year. 46 murders in a town of 250,000.
And the fourth highest rate of aggravated assaults. Why? Given our size, what was going on to make that happen?
It was a national trend, I think. There were a lot of – the baby boomers were becoming, you know, coming into their teenage and 20-year-old years. And when you have a lot of young people there, there's going to be a lot of problems. But I don't know why Charlotte would have been that way. It was a very transitory city even at that time. A lot of people were coming in and coming out. Could have had something to do with it.
You looked at median salaries, and you looked at several different careers. What were people doing when they came to live here, and how much money did they make?
So the $9,000 figure that I had in there was the median household income. So that's about equivalent to about $60,000 today. Charlotte was always a middle-class town, a white-collar town, and that's where people were coming to Charlotte to work in research and loan officers.
A lot of traveling salesmen.
Yeah. Well, 12,000 of them.
This was the place to get off the farm, to get out of the textile factories? Why would you want to come to Charlotte in 1968?
To move up the economic ladder, and I think there's a parallel today.
So when you say the median income was $9,000, which equates to $60,000 of today's dollars, what is the median income today?
It's about what it is in Charlotte.
So we never really get ahead, do we? We just keep up with inflation.
The way to look at it is we started out ahead, and we're still ahead.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
That's one of the engines that a city creates, is this by bringing people together. And David Walters can talk about this more than I can. But these are places where synergies happen, where people start new businesses. And for most of recorded history, I think, cities have been where there is more prosperity, generally, more opportunities for the little guy to get ahead. And that's what pulls people to the city.
You, Chuck, and I keep coming back to this because I feel so old this morning. I'm told that you were not born in 1968.
No.
So when you are given an assignment to go back and write about 1968, could they have said, go write about ancient Rome, and it would have been the same thing to you?
In some ways, I'd done some, you know, I know people who lived during that time. I have, I'm a native North Carolinian, so I had family members who were around during that time. I think in a way it was interesting coming from this perspective, because I was able to sort of remove myself from any memories of that time and just look back
It's a fair look, because you weren't tainted by anything that you knew that had happened. 68, and we only have a minute left in this segment. You got to go, Tom. 68 was an eventful year. It was the summer of love. It was the Democratic National Convention with the riots in Chicago. Dr. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were both assassinated. Vietnam was becoming a flashpoint among young people. How caught up in that was Charlotte?
Not at all. Most of the 60s hit most of America in the 70s, and that was true in Charlotte as well. One of the places that is not a historic landmark, probably should be on Central Avenue, is the Hippie House, which was the first place where people came together and kind of lived together in a house. And it was front page news in the Charlotte Observer, and I can't remember the exact year, but it was like 1969, 1970.
Yeah.
If you think about the 60s, think more Bobby Soxers.
Okay, we're still stuck in the 50s then. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more of the history and the future of Charlotte in just a moment, thanks to Charlotte Magazine. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Center for Environmental Farming Systems Know Your Farms Tour, Saturday and Sunday, in partnership with the North Carolina 10% campaign, supporting local food producers, businesses, and communities. Tickets at knowyourfarmstour.com. And the Soul Kitchen, presenting music legend Roy Ayers, Friday at the Knight Theater. Tickets available at carolinaticks.org. You know, people in Europe look at us and see workaholics. And if you use comparisons of time that we spend at work versus on vacations taken, they're right. Putting work first and the demands placed on workers requiring them to do so is resulting in burnout, and corporations, believe it or not, are beginning now to take notice. They're examining the impact of work-life integration, and we'll look at how achieving that balance might affect employees, employers, and the bottom line tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in 3 weeks, uninsured Americans will be able to get coverage through state healthcare exchanges. Who will buy and why?
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the past and the future of Charlotte. Charlotte Magazine's September issue deals with its 45th anniversary, and they decided instead of talking about themselves to talk about Charlotte. They look back to 1968, their founding year. They look forward to 2058, which will be 45 years in the future. And joining us today to talk about all this is Michael Graff, executive editor of Charlotte Magazine, who wrote the article about the future. We'll be spending some time on that in a moment or two. Dave Walters is also here to talk about today and the future. He's an architect and planner at UNC Charlotte. And Chuck McShane is a freelance writer who wrote The Past, 1968, which is the article that takes us back to how Charlotte was 45 years ago. And you wrote your story, I love this, in the present tense. It starts out, you work in an office for Eastern Airlines or Celanese or Westinghouse. You're in distribution or sales or research for a textile company or a loan officer for a bank. Why did you write it in the present tense?
That's to capture that uncertainty, that people living in 1968 didn't know what was going to happen in 1969, just as we don't know what's going to happen in 2014. So by writing in the present tense, it's more action-oriented, and it also captures that uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen next.
For somebody who wasn't alive then, what did it feel like to go back and put yourself in the position of someone who was? Could you relate to it at all?
In some ways, yes. I mean, I think that one thing that ties Charlotte then and Charlotte now is that it was an aspirational city. It's a place people came to try to get ahead, and I think that's something that still exists here.
And this is before, who are the kingpin? Who are the leaders? This is before Hugh McCall. This is right. Before Ed Crutchfield. This is before, I think, before Bill Lee. I could be wrong about that. It was before Rolf Neal at the Observer. It was before all of these people that we've come to know as titans who built what Charlotte is today. So who were the people back then running the place?
Stan Berkshire was mayor at the time, and the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce was had a lot of power during that time. Berkshire moved from the president of the Chamber of Commerce to the mayor's seat in 1961, mm-hmm. and was mayor until 1969, and that was common then.
I meant to ask Tom Hanchett before he had to leave to go to another appointment from the Levine Museum in the New South about this, because the Levine Museum's permanent exhibit is Cotton Fields to Skyscrapers, and 1968 sounds like, I could be wrong about this, but it sounds like the fulcrum year, when things began to tilt from what Charlotte used to be to what Charlotte is. Would that be accurate?
I think in some ways, yes.
David?
I think it's hard to pick a single fulcrum, and there isn't really a metaphor for multiple fulcrums. Mm-hmm. It's even hard to say. But I think the late 60s was definitely a catalyst period. It essentially catapulted us into the era of suburbanization, which really dominated our city and most American cities during the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. And whether we think of it as a pendulum, which is a slightly simplistic, you know, we were urban, we moved to suburban, we're moving back mm-hmm. to a more urban appreciation. Whether it's as simple as that is one of the uncertainties about the future. I think things have changed significantly in terms of the factors that come to play in our suburban lifestyles that makes the equation between urban and suburban much more complicated now than it was then, because the late 60s and into the 1970s, it became a fairly simplistic condition. Urban bad, suburban good. And that simple cliche has dominated the way we've thought about cities for 30 years. And, you know, quite a few people, I think, still hold to that mantra. But when you really look at it, it's a lot more complicated than that.
And Chuck writes, and you do a great job, I think, of distilling what life was like. I wasn't here then. I was alive, but I wasn't living here. But there are comparisons to where I grew up and what Charlotte is today and what Charlotte was then. And what your words kind of just brought it all back to me. You write, if you're young and single and just starting out, you live in one of the new apartment complexes down South Boulevard or out Park Road. If you're raising kids, you live in a ranch house on the east side. If you're moving into middle management, maybe you get a nice two-story in one of the new subdivisions off Providence. If you're hard up for cash or into the hippie lifestyle, you share an old house or apartment in Dilworth where rent is cheap and pot is plentiful. Where were these apartments on South Boulevard and Park Road?
Some of them are still there today.
Uh-huh.
You go off of Elmwood Road. Between South Boulevard and Park Road, there are several apartments that are still there today.
And what about this hippie house in Dilworth?
So Dilworth was interesting. Freedom Park actually was called Hippie Hill, part of it. And that was basically an open-air drug market where marijuana was sold. The hippie house, so a lot of the old Victorian and 1920s houses in Dilworth have been subdivided at that time, and lots of people were basically flop houses. So there was concern that Dilworth was kind of on the downtick at that time.
But everything you talk about in that paragraph seems very close in to today standards. I mean, when people went home at night from working downtown, if they worked downtown, they weren't going very far.
No, not at all.
They weren't going – well, what were they? Was Fairview Road a road back then? Was Sardis Road around? I mean, how far out did Providence go before you fell off the end of the earth?
Well, I think there's a great line in Chuck's piece where he says down in that cow pasture where they're going to build this mall called South Park.
Yeah.
I think that explains a little bit about where we were at those days when Park Road Shopping Center was at the south end of town.
So if you're young and you're just starting out, as you write, you live in one of those new apartment complexes down South Boulevard. Is South Boulevard, that's South End now, is South Boulevard becoming what it used to be in the 1960s? Is it going through what it was, becoming what it was all over again?
Well, there are several versions of South Boulevard.
Right.
There's the North End, which is the North End of South Boulevard, obviously, is South End, which has undergone a massive transformation. The rest of it, in the magic words of former Mayor McCrory, it's a corridor of crap. And you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Quote, where
he's right.
He quite accurately described the generic, yet in many ways commercially thriving environment as you go further down south. And so that corridor is a real microcosm of the shifts in values and priorities, because the South End area, of course, and that's a manufactured place. I mean, there was no historic South End. I mean, that's a inspired developer's marketing term. Now is very much a place to live and increasingly actually a place to work as jobs move in there. But South Boulevard, as you move further south, is a wonderful microcosm of both the good and the bad things about in-migration, new businesses, old businesses fading and dying.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the architecture that we built in the 70s and 80s was generally so poorly designed and poorly built that it's left us a legacy of ugly buildings. And back to your earlier observation about it, 1968, it was the stuff we tore down to build the new stuff. That's the stuff we would fight to keep, because it was what we in our jargon call the texture of the city.
Well, we're looking back at the 60s, and you're saying here that the stuff we built in the 60s and 70s was poorly built and ugly now to our eyes. But would it be ugly to eyes in 2058, or would they look back on those buildings as we look back on what gave way to those buildings? And would the people in 2058 say, darn, I wish we'd kept whatever the building is on South Boulevard that you're talking about. I wish we'd kept that.
Well, I doubt whether the building would survive. You know, simply because the buildings we tore down in the 60s were built in the 20s out of more substantial materials, because that's just how
we built. Why did we change that habit? Why did we build bad, shoddy buildings in the 60s?
Because for a few reasons, our view of a life cycle of a building changed from many decades to 15 to 20 years.
Okay.
That related to the period of the loan, the financing mechanisms. They got shorter term, very impatient money.
So we began to think about building buildings like we think about buying cars.
Yes,
we want them to be obsolete.
Absolutely.
Keeps the money going, keeps the wheel turning.
Yeah.
Were we alone in that? We weren't alone in that.
No,
was a nationwide phenomenon.
Absolutely. And not only nationwide, you can find bits of Europe. You have to look a bit hard, but you can find bits of Europe which are exactly the same.
Did we plan and build neighborhoods to be that way?
That's a more difficult question, because I think we planned them in our minds for a longer life cycle. We didn't regard our homes as disposable as our workplaces. But with the wisdom of hindsight, the way we laid them out rendered them obsolete within really a generation or two. That the way they function now is not terribly sustainable as we move into an uncertain future.
The future is always uncertain, though, isn't it?
We hope so.
Okay.
It'd be awful if we knew, wouldn't it?
We talked a little bit about Brooklyn, and for people who have not lived here long, Brooklyn was an all-black neighborhood that was in Second Ward, which is today where the Blake Hotel and the Aquatic Center and the Government Center and south side of the 277 loop is, and it stretched from about Trade Street to where McDowell Street is and beyond, down into where Metropolitan is now. That was the lower end of that. And those were the real slums of Brooklyn, because they were in that quagmire created by Sugar Creek.
Yes, it was pretty unpleasant by all accounts. It was unpleasant.
The
down
closer
there.
You got to Trade Street, the better off people were and the nicer the neighborhoods were. And it was a complete neighborhood, a complete self-sufficient functioning neighborhood. But urban renewal came along here and in the rest of the country, and out it went. And you write in this article, if you're black, the West Side is becoming your only option. Is that why?
That's one of the reasons, yes. The city was sort of people were moving. There had already been a community of blacks on the West Side. Earlier, people had – some of the more middle-class blacks had fled Brooklyn for the West Side before this happened. Before Brooklyn was leveled. But that's one of the reasons. I mean, there was 1,000 people, 1,000 families, and 216 businesses displaced when Brooklyn was leveled in the 60s, who had to find someplace to go.
And this is the city, and I brought this up last night. I moderated a discussion with Mr. Kinsley with the Kinsley Collection at the Gantt Museum, and with Tom Hanchett. And this brings up something we kind of touched on last night, that this is a city that handled desegregation really well. Chamber of Commerce leaders and mayors and others went out with black leaders and sat at lunch counters in 1963 and integrated the lunch counters overnight, integrated restaurants overnight, with none of the problems that we experienced in the Deep South later on in the civil rights movement. And yet you write in your article that in 1968, you could still get evicted from your apartment for throwing an interracial party.
Yes.
How do we explain that in a city where we didn't have these problems?
Well, I think that the chamber and the political leaders were very strong and very behind desegregation, but maybe the rest of the population wasn't quite there yet.
Private property versus public.
Sure.
Okay. Let's move to the future here for a little while. Michael, you wrote the article about the future, and it's one thing to look back on the past because it's there in black and white. You can go through the microfiche and figure out what was what and who was who and why was why. But it's another thing to look toward the unknown. How did you approach that task?
Well, I started it the same way Chuck started his, actually. I tried to put myself back in 68 to start it, believe it or not, because I wanted to know, I wanted to feel what it was like to not know that things like that King would be assassinated that year. If you start that year in 68, you had no idea that was going to happen. And so I, you take that uncertainty and you try to live in that uncertainty when you try to write a story like this. And the next step was to talk to David.
Yeah, because David is the planner, and he's been instrumental in kind of in many things, but including starting a fairly hot dialogue about urban renewal, not urban renewal, but what's the word I'm looking for?
Urban revitalization.
And the whole new concept of how we should live.
Smart growth,
yes. How do you look at the future? 45 years in the future. We're not – none of us – well, you may be, Chuck, and Michael, you may be here, but the rest of – David and I will not be here in 2058 to see if you're right. So how do you look that far into the future and say, well, this is what it's probably going to be like?
It's a natural impulse for us to do it, and I think it's very important for us to really think carefully about the future, but it's almost impossible to get it right. There's a wonderful illustration that I have in one of my lectures about an image from 1953 from the Rand Corporation about mm-hmm. what they thought the home computer would be like in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the size of a room.
Mm-hmm.
It had multiple TV screens with valves and things. And the main operating device was a huge steering wheel. And these were the best minds in the computer industry.
And we also thought we'd have flying cars.
Yes. And so technology will transform things for us in ways that really we cannot imagine. I mean, we couldn't imagine the iPhone mm-hmm. 15 years ago.
Although you've taken the iPhone and the iPad and other screen-driven computer devices and projected what – how they might impact us in 2058. They won't be there anymore. iPhones and iPads won't be there anymore in your vision, but your house will be an iPad.
Yeah, imagine checking your email in the mirror, brushing your teeth in the morning. That type of existence where you can change your wallpaper by pressing a button.
So your wall will be a screen.
Essentially, yeah. Yeah. And some of these technologies are already there. You can find clips of some of these futuristic type of homes all over the web.
You know, they used to do World's Fairs on a regular basis, and every World's Fair had the future exhibit, the Futurama exhibit. And some of the things that they foresaw came true, but most of them did not. Do you feel as though this is a – how do you view this exercise in looking into the future? Is it futile? Is it fantasy? What is it?
No, I think back then people viewed it as a fan, or people came up with these visions that were fantasies. But nowadays, and talking to people like David and some of the other folks at UNCC and some of the designers I talked to and the real estate agents that I talked to about the future, everybody's very realistic. It's almost these are tempered mm-hmm. predictions of the future nowadays. Nobody goes out on a limb and says we're going to have a town on Mars anymore. We talk about things like we want gridded street patterns back and things like that.
But when George Jetson had a treadmill in his apartment in the sky, we thought, why? And now people have treadmills. And we're about to have Rosie the Robot, too, I'm told. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more of the future of Charlotte's in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3. Tonight at 11, reporting facts, getting answers, finding solutions. WBTV on your side, also on mobile app and at WBTV.com.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Honda Hickory, offering new and certified pre-owned Hondas to the Charlotte Metro and Western North Carolina on Highway 70 in Hickory and at HendrickHondaHickory.com. In 3 weeks, uninsured Americans will be able to get coverage through state health care exchanges. Today on the Diane Rehm Show, guest host Tom Jelton and his guests talk about who will buy those policies and why. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And we're going to continue talking about Charlotte and Charlotte's future in 2058. When we come back, you can join the conversation at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, among other ways.
Homeland, Hunger Games, The Bachelorette, the Charlotte region is scoring wins in the competition to land film and television productions. Join WFAE for a public conversation as we explore how the area's film industry works and what it means for the region. We'll also dive into the debate over state incentives for filmmakers. Thursday evening, September 19th at Discovery Place. Details and registration are at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the past of Charlotte back to 1968 and the future of Charlotte to 2058 because of the September issue of Charlotte Magazine. Michael Graff is the executive editor of that magazine. Chuck McShane wrote the article about the past. Michael wrote the article about the future, and David Walters consulted on that article in the future. He's an architect, planner, and coordinator at UNC Charlotte. Your article also begins with this interactive map, at least it does online, and it focuses on the central city, the downtown core, and it shows it's a picture of today, and then you hover your mouse over the interactive map, and all of the parking lots, like the one we're looking at out this window at Spirit Square across the street, they're no more. They're gone. They've been filled in with buildings. There are a lot of empty lots and surface parking lots in downtown Charlotte right now. They're going to be gone in 45 years, all of them?
This is the vision of a brilliant UNC Charlotte master's program graduate, Keely Moore, mm-hmm. who read the story that I wrote before she developed her own vision for what Charlotte would be like. We asked her to develop this rendering on her own, and she said, "What do you think about me just taking out all the parking lots and putting buildings there?" And I said, "If that's what you believe will happen, that's what you believe will happen." And she's done enough research to develop that vision. So.
You also write your article in the present tense. It's 2058, and you're writing it about someone who is 45 years old, but means they were born this year,
right.
2013. And you say that person came along at a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because this is an optimistic view of the future. That was the – when I set out to write this story, I had two choices. You write – either a pessimistic view or an optimistic view. And we wanted to – funny thing is David tells me at some point in the process, there is no guarantee that the future will be better than it is today. And that sort of shook me to the core. And I just said, no, I don't want that. We want our future in Charlotte to be better than it is today. We're Charlotte. We're a city that is always striving for the future, striving for something better in our future. So I imagined this child in a nursery in one of the hospitals today with on its back looking up, and you don't want that child to have a bad future. You want that person.
No, but all the other accounts that we hear about the future is that today's children will not be able to achieve what their parents did, which was to live better than their parents did, and because of the economy and because of the changing way we work and the outsourcing of jobs and the influx of robotics, et cetera, that it's going to be difficult for people to be as well off. But that shifts into the changing paradigm that you write about. The ambition is not going to be to have the 5,000 square foot home in the far-flung suburbs with six bedrooms and five and a half baths. It's going to be to live – this is going to be hard to believe for a lot of people today – in 1,500 square feet. You write – and this is from your article. You might not believe this, but before you were born, people shunned city living. Big sprawling developments dominated the region's growth in the 90s and 2000s. We had houses that were four and five bedrooms, McMansions, we called them. Then something happened. As technology advanced and we expanded our digital lives and talked to people halfway around the world in mere seconds, we stopped expanding our physical living spaces outward. Really, are people going to want to live with a family in 1,500 square feet?
Quality over quantity, I think, is going to be the mantra of the future. I think in those 1,500 square feet, you're going to want to have really good furniture rather than have a whole lot of furniture. Really nice rooms rather than 22 rooms or whatever you want to have and whatever we thought we were on our pace for. I don't know that... that I agree with the statement that the children today won't have it better than their parents did, because it just depends on what you think is a good life.
Well, not all of this is fantasy. Not all of this projection into the future is fantasy. It has a real foundation in fact, and you talk about this 45-year-old person in 2058 having been born this year, and when he or she was born, he or she was among about 500 children who were born at Carolina's Medical Center each month, and that's just one hospital. What does that portend for population growth between now and 2058? Not counting the people who will come here from other places.
Well, I mean, it's not always possible to pass out homegrown growth versus sort of folks moving in, but all the reliable census projections in round numbers have us basically doubling by that time. Mm-hmm. You know, so there will be twice as many people. There'll be a lot more jobs, there'll be a lot more activity, and the issue of whether we choose to live in smaller spaces is really tied to those changing demographics. I mean, one of the hardest things for all of us to accept now is the fact that Charlotte, just by existing, is going to change dramatically in terms of having twice as many people. So do we get twice as big, which means that we would have to double, triple the taxpayer support for services. So in order to maintain our big lifestyle, property taxes will have to go through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think that's going to happen, do we? There'll be a big revolt, big pushback against higher taxes to support the ever-increasing infrastructure. So the only way to keep that kind of taxation structure within reasonable bounds is to live smaller, get more use out of the same space, get multiple uses out of the same space. So I don't believe for one moment that we're going to wake up at some point in the future and say, let's live smaller today. We're not going to do that.
It's just going to happen.
It's just going to happen because to keep living bigger and bigger and further out and further out, either when we won't have the money to support those far-flung suburbs and they will actually deteriorate, mm-hmm. lose value and people will move, or we'll say we refuse as taxpayers to support that.
Well, also, you and I have talked about this on other programs, the city is pretty much maxed out in terms of what it can annex. And that's how they've been able to keep property taxes low, by annexing new areas and bringing in more people. And so it's a zero-sum yeah. game. But that's stopped. That's done. Yes. It's over. So roads cannot be expanded any more than pretty much than they've been already done. So we have to change how and what we're building and how and where we live. Correct?
That's absolutely right, and it's not a party political issue. It's not a partisan issue. I know there are many different opinions, across the spectrum, but I think the unifying principle will be living within our means, mm-hmm. because there is only so much public money to provide all the necessary infrastructure, and citizens will continue to expect the same level of service, if not improved service. So that's going to have to be provided to a more compact area. That's just basic economics.
Your article goes to 2058 because it's the 45-year projection out for the 45th anniversary of Charlotte Magazine. But you attended a thing called Reality Check 2050, which is with UNC Charlotte and others, to kind of bring things into focus. David just mentioned that we're going to double in size in terms of population between now and 2058. That means the 14 county region's population will go from 2.4 million in 2010 to 4.24 million in 2050. That makes us the size of Boston today in 40 years. That also, it seems to me, means that regions outside of the city of Charlotte, Union, York, Gaston, Lincoln, Cabarrus, Iredell counties will have to take up the excess population. They will have to change, will they not?
Absolutely, they will. And we as a region are going to have to figure out ways to get those people into town on a transportation scale, on the matter of transportation. When they grow, if they want to work here, We can't simply widen every road out to them. So absolutely the region's going to grow, but all the trends, I think, show that that this is the first time in a decade that Charlotte will grow faster than the surrounding region.
And we've had significant disagreements over new urbanism, which is what we're talking about, the changing the way we live because we have to conform to the reality of not being able to expand, wanting to keep the taxes low, et cetera, and accommodate expanding populations. It's been difficult in Charlotte to talk about this. It's been very political. It's been very people of gnashing of teeth and rending of garments. Are the outlying counties prepared for this? Because they're relatively rural as opposed to urban.
I think it's really going to be hardest for the outlying counties to come to terms with the changes. In some ways, Charlotte is in a good position that it understands many aspects of the problem. It knows what needs to happen. There isn't political agreement on how to do that. But I think certainly our region in the future, while Charlotte will remain the economic powerhouse and a prosperous Charlotte means a prosperous region, the more rural counties will develop more urban centers within themselves, more local areas of focus, so that each county will, while it depends for its overall economic health on a prosperous Charlotte, will become more self-sustaining in terms of jobs, in terms of things like food production, energy production. The host of challenges, I mean, we could just recite the list and then we'd run out of time at the end of the program. But water is one. You know, the battle between North Carolina and South Carolina about water rights in the Catawba, there isn't enough. There will not be enough water by 2050. There will not be enough water. It won't come out of the taps.
So what are we going to do?
Nobody knows.
Okay. And are you sticking with your story that life's going to be better, Michael?
I'm absolutely sticking with it.
The fact that we don't know now doesn't mean that we won't know then.
Okay.
It means that, you know, we are bright enough to solve this. We really are. But we've got to try and put political bickering behind us. That would be our undoing.
You also write about baby boomers, because you can't write anything today without writing about baby boomers. We're going away soon enough. So just, you know, I'm glad you gave us a kind of parting glance. You're saying that you write about how cities will change going forward into the 21st century because of baby boomers who didn't want to get old, and so cities had to adapt. How will Charlotte have to adapt?
To
the baby boomers not wanting to get old.
Well, the baby boomers want to have the same access to things that their children do. The millennial generation, they want to have the same fun that they are. They want to be able to walk to the grocery stores. They want to have an active lifestyle. They want to live close to the food truck rally down here on Friday nights. Mm-hmm. They want to take part in it.
So will they be driving this, what you're saying is going to be a doubling of the population inside the 277 loop, or actually tripling the population inside the 277 loop by 2050? Will they be the front end of that tripling?
I don't know that they will be. I know that with this millennial generation, that's certainly going to be a driving force behind it. At one point during the course of writing the story, David told me, he said, "How old are you?" And I said, 33. And he said, "You're in Generation X. You don't matter."
Yes, you're right about people don't matter. I remembered that. Chuck writes
Not you personally, I would say. I was personifying a generation who are very nice people, but they're a small generation. They don't affect the taste-making.
Yeah, the heck with them. Chuck writes about what people did in 1968 when they came to Charlotte, why they lived here, and what kind of money they made. What will people be doing for a living when they come to Charlotte in 2058? Will we be a banking town? Will we be an energy town? Or something else we can't even envision at the moment?
I think that goes back to the first line of the story, "You come along at a good time." Because I think what we learned in 2008 from the banking crash here was that we couldn't be one thing. We have to be a bunch of things. And I think we're getting ready to figure out what Charlotte will become as a an employer, a city that employs people.
Will we still be the biggest city in the Carolinas, you think?
I'm not entirely sure about that. David might be able to answer that better than I will. I knew that Raleigh-Durham is growing pretty quickly, but
I think it'll be a very close-run thing because what the Triangle has as an advantage is a bigger footprint in the knowledge economy. That's a terrible metaphor, isn't it? A bigger footprint in the knowledge economy. They got more universities. We got good universities here. They got more of them there. They've got more access to future thinking than we do here. We're moving fast to catch up. But I think the key, I mean, we won't be known for one thing. I think that's the key thing. Even as a major metropolitan center, we will have to become more locally sufficient. Self-sufficient is perhaps too grand an objective that we would get everything locally. But I think one of the things that will give us more certainty in the future is to rely less on far-flung places and things over which we have no control. Mm. That the more we can influence locally, the more we can create a sustainable future.
David Walters is an architect and planner who contributed some background, deep background, for the story in about the future of Charlotte. It appears in the 45th anniversary edition, the September edition of Charlotte Magazine. It looks back to 1968, thanks to Chuck McShane, who wrote the article The Past, and Michael Graff, who wrote the article The Future, and he's also the executive editor. Thank you all for being here, including Tom Hanchett from the Levine Museum, who had to leave early. The interactive maps, link to those maps, can be found on our website at WFAE.org. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.